Hey there, Marco here. Before we start the show, I have some great news to share amongst all the chaos. We surpassed our end-of-year campaign goal. Yep, as you know, since October, we asked you every week to contribute to the work we're doing, and from across the globe, you answered the call. Together, we have raised over $130,000, a truly incredible show of support from you. Not only does it keep the engine of the production going, but it reminds our whole team that you are out there listening, and that what we do at The World matters to you. So from everyone here in our newsroom, we just can't thank you enough. Now, on to the show.
The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
It's official. Donald Trump is the first U.S. president to be impeached twice, 1 week after the Capitol building was attacked. People who study extremism are asking what other violence could happen before Biden's inauguration.
All bets are off until January 20th.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, Canada reckoning with its own extremist groups.
As of 2016, we have in every single province in Canada at least one American-style militia.
And in Ireland, the state apologizes to thousands of women and children.
I apologize for the profound generational wrong visited upon Irish mothers and their children who ended up in a mother and baby home.
Church-run institutions. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Donald J. Trump has become today the first president in U.S. history to be impeached two times. The final tally, 232 to 197 to impeach. 10 Republicans joined the Democrats in their vote. Meantime, residents of Washington, D.C. are seeing thousands of National Guard troops deployed across the Capitol to prevent violence in the days ahead, now with just a week until the inauguration of Joe Biden as the 46th president. The impeachment vote also comes exactly 1 week after the Capitol building came under violent attack by extremist supporters of President Trump. The World's Matthew Bell has this look at today's impeachment proceedings.
As things got underway this morning, the argument in favor sounded like this.
This was not a protest. This was an insurrection.
Massachusetts Democrat Jim McGovern opened the proceedings inside the Capitol building, which he referred to as a crime scene.
These were domestic terrorists, Mr. Speaker, and they were acting under the orders of Donald Trump.
The article of impeachment before lawmakers is just 4 pages long. It charges President Trump with incitement of insurrection against the government of the United States. Republicans argued against it. Here's Tom Cole from Oklahoma.
After the traumatic events of last week, the majority should be taking steps to unite us. Instead, they are only dividing us further. They are rushing to judgment, in my opinion, and bringing up impeachment after failing to follow any meaningful process whatsoever.
Cole condemned the attack on the Capitol. He said Trump's words from that day cannot be defended. But he told fellow members of Congress that they needed to slow down and think more clearly about the consequences of their actions. As for the Republicans' call for unity, Democrat Jim McGovern had this to say.
What happened would never have happened if everybody stood up in unity and called out the president when he was not telling the American people the truth, when he was pushing a big lie. We will never have unity without truth and also without accountability.
With Biden's inauguration next Wednesday, Republicans said Congress should move past the events of last week. But one after another, Democratic House member spoke about the urgency of the matter. They say every moment Donald Trump is in office, the nation is in danger. Minnesota Democrat Ilhan Omar.
We cannot simply move past this or turn the page. For us to be able to survive as a functioning democracy, there has to be accountability. We must impeach and remove this president from the office immediately so that he cannot be a threat to our democracy.
But Republican Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy says impeachment is a mistake because it just fans the flames of partisan division. He also had this to say.
That doesn't mean the president is free from fault. The president bears responsibility for Wednesday's attack on Congress by mob rioters. He should have immediately denounced the mob when he saw what was unfolding. These facts require immediate action by President Trump. Accept his share of responsibility. Quell the brewing unrest, and ensure President-elect Biden is able to successfully begin his term.
McCarthy said the conspiracy theory that Antifa led the deadly attack on the Capitol is not true. He said there should be a fact-finding inquiry into what did happen, but he described the impeachment effort as a partisan witch hunt. The leading Republican to vote yes was Representative Liz Cheney from Wyoming. Ahead of today's debate, she said, "There's never been a greater betrayal by the President of the United States." For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
New videos surfacing from last week's siege of the Capitol building show the attack was both chaotic and coordinated. Some of the rioters wore earpieces to communicate with each other. In this clip, a woman with a bullhorn maps out the building's floor plan with men in camouflage. She tells them which window they need to break to gain entry into another room.
In the other room on the other side of this door, there is a glass that if it's broken, you can drop down into a room underneath it.
This sort of domestic threat is nothing new to J.M. Berger. He's the author of the book Extremism. Berger is a fellow with Vox Pol, a European Union initiative that studies all forms of extremism. Berger says his most urgent questions are how and where the large radicalized community of extremists in the U.S. will act next.
Sometimes when there's a large terrorist-style attack such as this, there will be a backlash and people will settle down and we'll see a different kind of landscape, but not a huge outpouring of violence. I think the next couple of days running up to the inauguration are really going to dictate what that looks like.
As far as you can see, are the ringleaders, at least, of last Wednesday's siege being arrested?
Well, that's a really good question. I'm not so sure they are. Certainly, the people who took selfies and had their pictures taken are being arrested, and some of the people who were particularly kitted out for violence, people who are carrying zip ties and wearing body armor, some of those have been arrested. I have not seen a lot of discussion of organizers. So what I haven't seen yet is, you know, an arrest that says this is the leader of this particular neo-Nazi group who sent five people to this event. So I would like to see more of that kind of arrest.
So, JM, as you say, the week ahead looks really ominous. There are suggestions that there could be pro-Trump protests in a lot of places, not just in Washington. What are the big questions on your mind when you think about how this threat's going to evolve, especially in the days ahead?
So the big question right now is how much of this very large vocal online community is actually willing to show up to do violence and to risk arrest. There's ample evidence for a really massive presence of people who have been radicalized to some extent, who are extremely upset about the election, have been consuming misinformation about it, and who are willing to engage in violent rhetoric about that online. The question is how many of those people are willing to take the next step? And I think we won't know until after the 20th really what that looks like. And then after that, we'll have a better sense of what to expect under the Biden administration. You know, are we looking at a rolling insurrection or are we looking at just elevated lone wolf style attacks on various places? The turnout that we see over this weekend will help shape my expectation of what we're going to be looking at going forward.
Representative Ilhan Omar, the Democrat from Minnesota, told the Daily Beast, the answer is not a broader security structure or a deeper police state. And she argued that the last thing we need in response to recent events of last Wednesday is another 9/11 kind of war on terror, which, as we know, morphed into different things, not just fighting terror, strictly speaking. Do you think she's right?
Yes. You know, this is a complicated problem that we've created for ourselves. And I think a lot of policies that were instituted in the war on terror were certainly excessive and pushing the boundaries of civil rights. And most importantly, they were disproportionately applied to Muslim communities and communities of color. And it's a little bit of a catch-22 when you get to this moment, because it's kind of a teachable moment for white people. You may have seen a lot of videos online of people who are at the Capitol rally discovering that they've been put on no-fly lists and right, getting very upset. And there's a temptation to greet that with a lot of schadenfreude because, you know, these are the policies they wanted to institute against people who are not like them. So I think, you know, a lot of people on the left, activists, have been correctly arguing that this is an opportunity to teach people what it's like to be on the receiving end of these policies. Where I'm less confident is that they're going to learn that lesson and they're going to endorse looser policies for people who are not like them. So I'm worried about an expanded police state, I don't think we'll probably be looking at that, but it really, again, depends on what happens in the next few days.
Yeah, so do you think the rise of white nationalist terrorism around the world is something like the rise of the Islamic State? How's it the same, and where are the differences?
The good news is that we don't see the kind of extreme violence that ISIS carried out in this broad movement. The bad news is that there are some extremely violent elements underneath this broad movement that would definitely do the kind of stuff that ISIS does if they got the chance. And the other big difference in terms of thinking about like a threat from ISIS versus thinking about this threat is that ISIS never had any meaningful presence in this country. I mean, you know, we're talking, when you look at the number of people who've been arrested and the number of people who supported the movement, we're talking about a fraction of a percent of the American population and only a tiny fraction of a percent of the Muslim population that they were targeting for recruitment. And white nationalism, on the other hand, is 15 to 30% of Americans. And that's a much bigger problem. So even if it's not as extremely violent as ISIS, it could still potentially be much more disruptive to our lives.
J.M. Berger is the author of the book Extremism. He's a fellow with Vox Pol, a European Union initiative that studies online extremism. J.M. Berger, thanks very much for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Okay, next let's turn to Russia and a big political controversy there. It's quite a saga involving the near-fatal poisoning of Alexei Navalny. He's one of President Vladimir Putin's harshest critics and one of Russia's top opposition leaders, now in exile. The World's Daniel Offman has the latest Navalny news, including a big turn in the story, expected this weekend.
It all began last summer.
The most prominent Russian opposition leader is in a coma on a ventilator. Alexei Navalny is the latest enemy of Vladimir Putin to fall victim to possible poisoning.
Last August, Alexei Navalny was on a domestic flight from Siberia to Moscow. That's when he lost consciousness. The pilot made an emergency landing in the Siberian city of Omsk.
A medically equipped plane has been flown to Omsk by a German charity who want to evacuate him. But his wife, Yulia, claimed the authorities were refusing to let him go.
Eventually, they let Navalny out of the country. He was flown to Berlin for treatment, where independent scientists confirmed that he was in fact poisoned with a military-grade nerve agent called Novichok, a substance developed in Russia. On September 7th, Alexei Navalny came out of his coma. In an interview with 60 Minutes, he spoke about what happened to him.
I think for Putin, why he's using this chemical weapon to do both, kill me and, you know, terrify others.
Investigative journalists collaborated with Navalny to track down who targeted him. Many signs pointed to the FSB, the Russian Federal Security Service. They say that FSB agents were following Navalny in the months before the poisoning. Here's Christo Grozev, a reporter with Bellingcat, an investigative news organization.
No alternative explanation could justify and explain the close tailing by chemical weapons experts and by doctors of Navalny, plus the peaks in communication just before and after these trips that tailed Navalny.
Right now, Navalny remains in Berlin, 5 months after he was poisoned. But he said he'd return to Russia as soon as he was healthy. So today, Navalny posted an announcement. Navalny said he feels healthy enough to go home. He'll fly back to Moscow on Sunday, and he's called on his supporters to greet him at the airport. There's already speculation, though, that he could be arrested immediately. But Navalny has said that for him, returning home to Russia is a no-brainer. And by the way, the airline that Navalny will be flying on is called Pobeda, the Russian word for victory. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman.
Just ahead on the show, the WHO's attempts to get inside China. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The pandemic began a year ago in Wuhan, China. This week, a team of scientists with the World Health Organization finally hits the ground in China for the first major investigation into SARS-CoV-2. The mission has been mired in politics, but scientists hope to finally gain important new details about the disease and its spread. The World's Alana Gordon has been following the WHO mission. Who is on this team, Alana, and what is the goal?
So, Marco, this is an international team of virus hunters from around the world, and that includes scientists from Germany, Australia, Japan, Vietnam, Russia, the U.S. lots of folks. Marian Koopmans is a virologist from the Netherlands. She's part of the team. And this is how she explained to Chinese television this week the goal of their mission.
We have been asked to take a deep look at the question, can we understand how this pandemic started? What was the origin of the pandemic? There are, of course, ideas about where the virus originally has come from, most likely bat reservoirs, but can we somehow reconstruct how exactly that happened?
So this mission is looking into the origins of the virus, where exactly it came from, and how it made its way to humans. This can seem like a direct question, but it can be complicated because, like, what animals might have been that intermediary animal that allowed the virus to make that jump?
So how will they be able to figure something like that out?
So to start, there's a lot of mapping and reconstructing of what happened. That begins in Wuhan with that first outbreak. It's detective work. It's like piecing together information, what we know about that first cluster of people who were infected, where to go from there. But they're also using much more advanced scientific techniques, something like genomic sequencing of samples of animals. Sean Griffiths is an emeritus professor at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. She's not part of this team, but I talked to her because she knows a bit about disease investigations. She was a lead on an international investigation of SARS back in 2003 in Hong Kong.
Can you piece together this chain of events, by looking at that level? Can you use science to give you the answer?
And Marco Griffiths says 15 years ago, information just didn't flow as quickly between countries as it does today. But at the same time, they were able to investigate that outbreak much sooner than this group going to China today.
Right. So, Alana, this mission is happening a year into the pandemic. Can scientists really get to the bottom of this?
Many researchers refer to this kind of work as searching for a needle in a haystack. And so there's a lot to be careful about in building up the hype. But any new clue they learn can be super exciting if it adds to an understanding of how the virus spreads. I talked with Dr. Daniel Lucy about this. He's not with the team. He's a virus hunter at Georgetown. He even went to China on his own last year to try to learn more, but says he just couldn't get access. So Lucy has so many questions about the outbreak, for example, at the market in Wuhan, and will closely be following what this team can actually learn now.
So at a bare minimum, I consider obtaining this hopefully accurate, truthful, factual information about the humans and about the live animals is a litmus test.
This hopefully accurate, truthful, factual information. I mean, the WHO mission, Alana, had been delayed from China for so long. U.S. leaders have accused China of covering up the effort. There's obviously a lot of political tension here. So could all this impede the mission of the WHO?
Like you said, there's a lot of politics and tension in all of this. China's really been pushing this question of, did the coronavirus even originate there? So what the WHO says it's trying to do is make this as objective as possible. Even the appearance, Marco, of politics being present, of looking to blame anyone for the outbreak, can get in the way of honest communication on the ground. Mike Ryan, WHO's emergency operations director, he got really impassioned about this week.
Let this mission and let other missions be about the science, not about the politics. We are looking for the answers here that may save us in future.
So more on all of that to come.
The world's Alana Gordon. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
Huawei is a leading Chinese tech company. One of its specialties is surveillance technology. And one group of people that the Chinese government closely monitors is Uyghurs, a Muslim minority in Western China. Now it's come to light that a Huawei patent for a video surveillance system mentions its facial recognition ability to identify people's ethnicity, including Uyghurs. Huawei has previously said that none of its technologies was designed to identify ethnic groups. Maya Wang is a senior China researcher at Human Rights Watch.
I have looked at the response from various companies, and they generally kind of say, well, we don't do that, or we did that and it was regrettable. I think some of these are pretty technical arguments in that the technology itself may not be detecting people's race at the moment of detection, but that in the system itself are linked to such detection in the database. So let's say you're walking in front of a camera. The camera does not say that you're a white person on the basis of your facial features, but it is identifying you with your features and going back to the back end to identify that person. And in the Chinese government database somewhere, it says you are a white person, because the ID, actually the police system identifies you as such. So this is how I think they're making some technical arguments about why this technology might not be at that instant of detection actually identifying race.
But even the way you describe it, kind of triangulating facial recognition with other data, I mean,
correct.
Do you believe that's in use now? And is that essentially the same thing?
Well, the impact and the result is the same. And these companies are essentially doing technical gymnastics to wiggle themselves out of responsibilities. Because the Ministry of Public Security, the Chinese police, are running this big surveillance system across the country, the purpose of which is social control of the entire Chinese population. A large part of that is a racist idea that all Uyghurs are dangerous. And they're tracking them and identifying them and targeting them throughout the country. Now, these companies are supplying various levels of systems that enable that to take place. They are using in their marketing material describing these functions. As a result, they are contributing to these abuses. So regardless of what they actually say, as long as the Chinese Ministry of Public Security are using video surveillance in that way, they are supplying the police in these systems, they are complicit in these abuses.
Do you know if Huawei surveillance technology is being used in the U.S.?
I actually don't know as much about their business in the U.S. I would say that there has been an expansion of Huawei technologies globally. And the concern is not just this one company. The concern is a whole range of technologies being used are increasingly provided by companies based in China and beholden to the Chinese government. So talking about Huawei is somewhat a bit of a misfocus when the focus should really be, what are we going to do when much of the world is going to be dependent on Chinese technologies and we don't really know what really goes on there and can't hold these companies accountable?
I want to just go a little further on that. As you see these surveillance technologies propagate, what thoughts occur to you?
I think that often people fear, and fear allows for a deepening of the surveillance when they should be addressed through other means. I think that both in the U.S. and across the world, we're seeing an increased collection of data that is unrestrained, and that we could very well lose our democracies if we don't get on top the further development of technologies that can subvert democratic liberties.
Maya Wong is a senior researcher on China for Human Rights Watch. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Maybe this will surprise you or not. About 2 billion people eat insects on a regular basis.
At the beginning of humankind, every one of us was a bug eater. Probably insects were the first animal protein to be consumed by humans.
What the EU is adding to its official list of safe edibles, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We come to you from GBH and PRX. Tomorrow, election day in Uganda. Millions are expected to vote in their presidential election. The incumbent, Yoweri Museveni, is a longtime U.S. partner and has ruled the country for more than 30 years. Now Museveni faces a challenger. He's a pop singer named Robert Chagulani, better known as Bobby Wine. I'm joined by The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gikandi. She's in Kampala, Uganda's capital. What is the atmosphere like, Halima, the day before the vote?
Here in Kampala, if you would have walked around today, you would have seen an increase in security. And I'm talking about army, military, police, military tanks going about town, soldiers on the street. And that's not to mention the internet shutdown. The internet isn't working right now. I can't access it, even using a VPN. And yesterday, there was also a shutdown of social media. So the big question for me is, how can any election be free and fair when Ugandans can't even access information?
Uganda's government has gotten a lot of criticism about the way they've handled the lead-up to the election. What have you seen so far that seems concerning?
The Museveni's government has faced a lot of criticism from both local and international human rights organizations, especially concerning its treatment of the opposition. Bobby Wine, as well as other opposition leaders and candidates, have been arrested multiple times, have been harassed. Some say they've been beaten. On top of that, election observers will be scarce here. Election observers from the European Union won't be here. And today, the U.S. said that it will cancel its observer mission because the majority of their staff weren't granted permission to come and observe the elections. And the response from one election commissioner I spoke with today was that he said that COVID was the issue, that because of COVID, fewer election observers could attend. But many people, including the opposition, have accused the government of using COVID as an excuse to limit or put restrictions on this election.
So Halima, let's talk about the voters. Uganda has a large young population. What are you hearing from them about tomorrow's election?
Well, many young people support Bobi Wine or Robert Chagulani. The former musician has captured the spirit of youth. A lot of young people, he represents change as a face of Uganda's youth population, and they also relate with him. Bobi Wine came from, quote-unquote, as he says, the ghettos of Kampala. And some people think that he would be the person to be a voice for him and rather than Uganda's elite. And here in Kampala is in some ways the center of Bobi Wine's support. That said, many people I've also spoken with here do support Museveni.
Yeah, I mean, Museveni has been in power for more than 30 years. Who are his supporters now and how do they connect with him?
As I mentioned before, really Kampala tends to be the center of support for Bobi Wine. That said, here I've spoken with people who support Museveni and especially his campaign for, quote unquote, securing Uganda's future. That's something that resonates with many people I've spoken with. I spoke with one woman who remembered stories of conflict that her parents told her, and she doesn't want to return to that period in Uganda, and she thinks Museveni will keep the peace, keep Uganda's stability. And indeed, in his past more than 30 years in office, Uganda has seen a period of relative development and peace compared to what happened before.
We spoke on the show yesterday, Halima, about how Uganda's government has been accused of human rights violations, and there are concerns about more political violence in the days and weeks to come. What have you been hearing?
Indeed. I mean, there has been violence during this election. One human rights lawyer told me this was the most violent election he's seen. What's interesting here is this week, especially both sides, as in the government and opposition, have been kind of accusing the other of violence. Either way, that is a concern that ordinary Ugandans have. But essentially, those who support Museveni and his party have expressed concerns that if Bobi Wine loses the election, then his supporters might take to the streets and that could become violent. But Bobi Wine supporters, they say their concern is that security officials and police will crack down on them, which is something that indeed we've seen during this election.
So the vote is tomorrow. When can we expect results?
Well, we're expecting results 48 hours from tomorrow. At least that's what one election commissioner I spoke with today said. So that means Saturday we're expecting results. And today I visited the National Tally Center, which is where results will be released. Security is very tight there. You actually need a negative COVID test just to enter tomorrow. But if the internet's off, who knows when we'll actually be able to confirm information and who knows when Ugandans will hear the results.
The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gikandi, covering the presidential election in Uganda, speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. Halima, thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
The U.S. Capitol crisis has prompted a public debate in Canada about white extremism within its own borders. This weekend, Canada's public safety minister, Bill Blair, said the government is considering designating the Proud Boys, a far-right extremist group involved in the Capitol riots, a terrorist group. David Hoffman has studied the rise of white extremism in Canada. He's a professor of sociology at the University of New Brunswick. David, designating the Proud Boys a terrorist group, what would that change, and how important do you think this consideration is?
It has symbolic value, but as an expert in this field, I am of the opinion that it doesn't have any real strategic value. What it means is essentially that they can be tried and be found criminally liable under the Canadian Criminal Code for group membership. So typically that we do not outlaw group membership in Canada. You can be a member of an organized crime group. You could be a card-carrying mafia member, but that is not technically illegal in Canada. It's the activities associated with being a member of that group. So when one of these groups is designated as a terrorist group in Canada, group membership is then illegal and they can be tried just for being a member. And here's the problem if the Proud Boys does get designated a terrorist group in Canada, it'll cause them to dissolve, but the members still are present. It doesn't change the members' ideas. What's going to happen, and what actually frequently happens, is they fracture and they reform and form frequently.
Well, beyond just the Proud Boys, you've also been tracking the rise of other white extremist groups in Canada. What is going on?
Probably the biggest development and the most concerning to Canadian scholars of far-right extremism is the presence of American-style paramilitaries in Canada. As of 2016, we have in every single province at least one American-style militia. Groups of individuals carrying assault weapons, engaging in military-style exercises on the weekend, and probably more shockingly, their ideology surrounds this concept that there's some sort of inevitable conflict, usually racially based, sometimes based on religion, sometimes a mixture of the both, where they're preparing themselves to survive some sort of cataclysmic apocalyptical event, and they'll emerge from this event to establish a white ethno-nationalist state. It's again, this transplanting of the extreme far-right ideas from the United States into Canada.
I know you've also noticed some demographic shifts in who's joining these groups. What are you seeing?
Yeah, when we were thinking of far-right extremists in the 80s and 90s, typically it was an overall masculine demographic and a young masculine demographic. Within the last 5 to 7 years or so in Canada, it's not just a young, angry, white man anymore. We've seen an increase in older men. Women are also getting increasingly involved. And this is something that gets overlooked very often, not only in the Canadian literature, but in the American scholarly literature on far-right extremism.
You mentioned the Canadians who are emulating American-style militias. What is there to say about the networking between white extremists in Canada and the U.S.? Have those cross-border connections been growing?
Yes. I would dare say that they're so intertwined to a point where the Canadian far-right landscape cannot exist without some sort of connection, at least ideologically and operationally, with the American context. And I'll give you an example, actually. So in Canada, in the past year or so, we had a high-profile case of a Canadian soldier, a Canadian reservist by the name of Patrick Matthews, belonging to an American far-right movement called The Base.
The Base, that's also the translation of Al-Qaeda, interestingly.
Yes, it is. And it makes you think, right? When the news of this Patrick Matthews hit the media circuit, he fled to the United States when he was eventually arrested by American police. Mm-hmm. But here's a perfect example. There's these international ties, and the international cooperation between American groups and Canadian groups is extremely common. And a good chunk of our groups up here are chapters of American groups.
Has Canada been slow to recognize the threat of white extremism compared to other national security threats?
5 or 10 years ago, there was an idea of this type of far-right violence cannot happen here. It's not part of what it means to be Canadian. Mm. For example, there isn't a Second Amendment or gun culture here. There's a very, very small virulent, but it's not widespread. Some of the concepts of personal liberty that have been taken to the extreme, don't tread on me, that type of mentality is not ubiquitous in Canadian culture. These form some of the core components of the far right in America. And it's not like they aren't here in Canada, but again, because they're not so widespread, the people who do adhere to them in Canada, those types of ideas in Canada, find it very hard to recruit Canadians. So what we found is when American ideas that are unpalatable to your average Canadian make their way up here, they go through a process of Canadianization, where they will drop certain elements that doesn't resonate with Canadian culture in an attempt to make it appealing.
How was the attack on the U.S. Capitol seen in Canada?
To see one of our closest neighbors go through an event like this is it caused a moment of reflection, a moment of introspection. It's caused us to wake up a little bit.
David Hoffman is a professor of sociology at the University of New Brunswick in Canada. He studies terrorism. David, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
The Irish Prime Minister today issued a formal state apology to the survivors of Ireland's mother and baby homes, places where unmarried Irish women and girls were sent when they became pregnant from the 1920s right up until the 1990s.
And so on behalf of the government, the state and its citizens, I apologise for the profound generational wrong visited upon Irish mothers and their children who ended up in a mother and baby home or a county home.
The Prime Minister's apology follows a five-year investigation. The findings, he said, reveal a dark, difficult, and shameful chapter in Irish history. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
Frances Timmins was born in Madonna House, a mother and baby home in Dublin, in 1971. His mother, an unmarried woman, was kept at another institution and was rarely allowed to see her son. Timmins was still a child when he left the home, but he tells me his bad memories of his time there.
I do remember the very harsh place. I would have memories of an awful lot of upset and tears and crying and just generally not being happy.
Timmins, like many children in these homes, was included in two vaccine trials when he was just a toddler. His mother didn't give her consent. At the age of four, he was fostered out to a family, and he tells me the trauma of those first few years have stayed with him.
You know, I went to a foster family and I was abused in the house, the foster family I went to. So kind of, I had a lot of resentment. I drank a lot, did a lot of different things that so it had a very negative influence, I suppose, right into my late 20s, I suppose.
Timmins now runs a helpline for the survivors. He says struggles with addiction and relationship problems are common among many of those he talks to. Babies born in these homes were often fostered out or put up for adoption, many times against their mother's wishes, and some were sent to families abroad, mainly to the US. Today's report comes about following dogged research by a local historian in Galway. In 2012, Catherine Corliss uncovered records showing almost 800 babies had died in a mother and baby home in her local area of Tuam over a 40-year period. But she found no records of where the babies were buried.
Okay, all these deaths, where are they buried? They're not in the main Tuam graveyard. They're not in the mother's hometown graveyards. It is becoming quite obvious what had happened.
In 2017, an inquiry concluded what Corliss had suspected, that many of the babies had been buried in unmarked graves in the grounds of the home, some in an unused sewage tank. This week's report looks at 18 of those mother and baby homes in Ireland and found that 9,000 children died in those institutions over 60 years. That's 15% of all babies born there. Many of the mothers were also subjected to cruel emotional abuse, particularly during childbirth. Taoiseach Micheál Martin, the Irish Prime Minister, says the findings present a shameful image of Ireland.
It opens a window onto a deeply misogynistic culture in Ireland over several decades, with serious and systematic discrimination against women, especially those who gave birth outside marriage.
Mother and baby homes existed in other countries too, but more unmarried women were kept in these institutions in Ireland than anywhere else. The homes were financed by the Irish state and run mainly by the Catholic Church. But the Taoiseach says Irish society has to take collective responsibility for what happened.
We treated women exceptionally badly. We treated children exceptionally badly. We had a completely warped attitude to sexuality and intimacy. One hard truth in all of this is that all of society was complicit in it.
The Irish Prime Minister's comments have sparked anger among survivors. They say blaming society as a whole removes responsibility from the state, and in particular the Catholic Church. Here's historian Catherine Corliss speaking to Irish broadcaster RTE.
The apology from the state is not enough. The religious and the church must be brought into it and not to blame it all in society. Why is he picking out society? There's a lot of the survivors desperately upset over that.
Last night, the leader of the Catholic Church in Ireland, Archbishop Eamon Martin, did issue a statement of apology. He says the church was part of a culture in which people were frequently stigmatised, judged and rejected. All these reports of abuse in homes run by religious orders have been deeply damaging to the Catholic Church in Ireland. Michael Kelly is editor of the Irish Catholic newspaper.
The damage has been immense. The moral credibility of the church in many ways is in tatters in this country. And I think the depressing thing for the church to reflect on is this is all a result of its own making.
But Kelly tells me, despite the damage, the number of people going to Mass every week in Ireland remains among the highest in Europe. Round 1 in 3, he says. But the influence of the church in day-to-day life is massively reduced.
Certainly, if you were to compare it to large parts of the 20th century, the church has very, very little public influence. In the political sphere, I would say the church is considerably weakened. And I think that is no bad thing, because the church, when it's at its best, should be on the side of the marginalised, not siding with the powerful.
For survivors like Timmins, the report is a long time coming, but he's not convinced it goes far enough. Timmins says a criminal investigation needs to be launched into why or how thousands of babies died in these institutions.
Any information in regards to those children dying should be investigated by the police force in Ireland. We need to know exactly what happened. We're supposed to, you know, heal and move on. We will need to know the full truth.
Timmins says he wants an assurance from the Irish government that survivors of mother and baby homes will be looked after in their old age, and that the inquiry's recommendations are fully implemented. Above all, he says, don't let this be yet another report that ends up gathering dust on the desk of an Irish Prime Minister. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Travelling abroad often involves making sure you have all your vaccinations. If you are going to certain countries in the near future, you might have to show a coronavirus vaccination certificate. Today, Greece called on the European Union to create a vaccine certification system across Europe. Part of the thinking is to help tourism recover from the pandemic. To help us understand how the vaccination certificate might work, I'm joined by Dr. Alexandra Phelan. She's with the Center for Global Health Science and Security, also an assistant professor of microbiology and immunology at Georgetown University. Dr. Phelan, how tough could it be to implement this kind of vaccination certification system across the EU? And how effectively could it help to stop the spread of the virus?
So there are a number of considerations, Marco. There is firstly the sort of scientific basis and the evidence on which, you know, can what we can rely on. And then there are practical considerations about what the certification would try to cover. And then also there are legal questions, particularly under international law and the international health regulations. So the first of those is if we actually look at what do we know about what immunity vaccination currently gives us? If we're going to be giving people certification based on their vaccination status, we want to know whether they actually do have immunity. And that's not just for their from themselves, but also do they have the vaccines they've taken actually prevent them from transmitting the disease to other people?
It sounds like there could be unintended consequences if, for example, there are delays in getting people vaccinated.
Yeah. So, I mean, what we have globally right now is quite a bit of a patchwork, not only in what vaccines are available, you know, particularly high-income and upper-middle-income countries are disproportionately have access to vaccines. So that raises significant equity issues in terms of who will be given this certification to be able to travel. You know, any certification, whether it be from the EU or from the global community or from individual countries, really should be coupled with a significant commitment to ensure that vaccines are available globally and distributed to all, so that is not essentially a barrier to economic access.
I remember the days of the yellow card. It had the WHO logo on it. It showed travelers to some countries having been vaccinated against yellow fever. So this idea isn't new, but it seems it would have to be different and probably more vigilant. Is a comparison to the yellow card useful?
Yes. Yeah, so the carte jaune or yellow card is a great comparison because it actually shows us a couple of issues. The first is the carte jaune is still a requirement. It's under international law that governments may require travelers to show evidence of yellow fever vaccination. Now, under the international law, that is the only current vaccination certificate required that countries are allowed to require. So there's a big legal question here now that if countries want to go ahead or regional blocs like the EU want to go ahead, what we really need is to be having countries coming together and deciding whether we add a new certificate like the carte jaune to international law.
Well, at the end of this month, the U.S. will require a negative COVID test for foreign travelers arriving to the U.S. What do you think that's going to do to ease the rate of transmission in this country?
The reality is transmission is already the highest in the world here in the United States. We are the global epicenter of the pandemic, and transmission as it stands is uncontrolled. The US has imposed a number of restrictions already on international travel, and so, you know, whether this would have a significant impact, but you know, requiring a negative COVID test, given the variants, may be one tool in the arsenal, but it should not be relied upon. The reality is what we need to be doing is having a national effort that is, you know, providing support for businesses to be able to shut down, for us to actually go into doing the relevant measures we need to control transmission here in the United States and have the public health response strengthened and guided here and the vaccine rollout here in the US. And so my worry is, you know, whilst there may be some utility in some of these tools about, you know, bringing in potential and more cases of the new variant into the US, those measures will be a drop in the ocean if we're not trying to deal with what we're doing here already for transmission that is already bad enough.
Dr. Alexandra Phelan is with the Center for Global Health Science and Security. She's in Washington, where she's an assistant professor at Georgetown. Dr. Phelan, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Marco.
For the global context you need on the coronavirus, Follow the World, our reporting, brings you the important and smart voices from the front lines of the pandemic. That's all at theworld.org/coronavirus. Mealworms, they are safe to eat. That's the latest from the EU's Food Safety Agency. The maggot-like insect is the first bug the agency has ever approved. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
Today's announcement means that mealworms, or beetle larvae, can be ground down into flour for making bread and cookies, or eaten whole as a protein-packed crunchy snack. I'm told they taste a lot like peanuts. There's a growing, shall we say, edible bug industry in Europe, especially in the Netherlands. Investors have been pouring money into bug startups, and one new farm in France will be able to produce more than 100,000 tons of bugs a year. That is a lot of bugs. But will Europeans want to eat them?
Well, that's a good question. We don't know.
Giovanni Sugari researches consumer attitudes about food at the University of Parma in Italy. Some 2 billion people around the world eat insects on a regular basis, according to the UN. Bugs are popular in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and expensive gastropubs in New York. Sugari says they were even popular in Europe at one point, many thousands of years ago.
At the beginning of humankind, every one of us was a bug eater. Probably insects were the first animal protein to be consumed by humans.
Pliny, the Roman scholar, said that Roman aristocrats loved to eat mealworms. They reared them on flour and wine. Aristotle apparently chowed down on cicadas. But then, says Sugari,
over the centuries, over the millennia, with the invention of agriculture, they started to be seen as a negative element.
These days, Sugari says, there's a growing movement in Europe to eat bugs again. That's because there are nutritional benefits. They're high in protein, low in fat, and environmental benefits, too. Insect farming is more efficient than cattle farming, and bugs emit fewer greenhouse gases than cattle and pigs. But there are also some risks. In 2019, Swedish researchers pointed out that we just don't know enough about insect farming. Like, how do you produce the feed they eat? What happens when they escape and wreak havoc on the ecosystem? They said we might be creating an industry that replaces one environmental problem with another. The announcement today that mealworms are safe to eat is just a first step toward mass production. The European Commission still has to decide whether to approve them for supermarket shelves. So it may be some time before Europeans start chowing down like Aristotle. For the World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Mealworm pancakes, anyone? Hey, bring the maple syrup. You'll be good to go. The World comes to you from the Nana Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow. From PR.